Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for January 6th, 2010. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. I have a new feature for you, as promised in the first show of the new year, this time a Hacking 101 segment discussing the practice of performance tuning and the considerations of speed. However, due to something that happened today, I'm going to hold off on a couple of shoutouts that I originally had planned to share, and I'm going to skip the new hacker word of the week. I really hate to start the first show of the new year with such a downer, but I'll try to muddle through the best I can to find the silver lining and to share some commiseration and condolences with a very dear and close friend of mine, T. Morris, who lost his wife this morning. One of the most amazing aspects of podcasting, since I've been doing this for over 4.5 years now, is its capacity to surprise me. And that's really made possible by the conversational nature of this medium, that the listeners can reach out to the creators and vice versa, and dialogues and correspondences can be opened up so much more easily than with more traditional broadcast medium. Really, much in the spirit of open source, something I talk about quite a bit, communities spring up very naturally around peer media, and that invites this capacity for surprise, and also, on a more personal, on a closer level, the community of creators that I have been very fortunate and blessed to be involved in and met at many events, conferences, and conventions reminds me very much of the stories I read of the earliest freakers and hackers, that they're very welcoming. They're so generous with their friendship, with their time, with their eagerness to see other people create and succeed and grow. Unfortunately, not all of those surprises are positive ones. When we open ourselves up to that serendipity, to that opportunity to grow and to become more, to learn more, to meet more people, we also are opening ourselves up to these sorts of tragedies. And the only thing that I can do, again, is offer my condolences and commiseration, what sympathy I can muster for an unimaginable experience that my very dear friend, someone that I care for like a brother, must be going through right now, and his very young daughter, who also is affected by immensely, unimaginably so, by this loss, and really stick to the fact that there is a wider community of his readers, his listeners, of his peers that are there to support him. And I hope that, though they're not going to express it this way, and I know that, this is just my way of thinking about it, that in holding the hacker ethic, something that I try to strive for and try to understand, in particular, some of the very positive aspects of this, that in everything that we do, in every relationship we undertake, every collaboration, every project, that we're striving to produce beauty in the world and focusing on that positive outcome rather than succumbing to the pettiness that very often we see other people fall prey to, and also that ability to affect positive change. And in this sense, and in this sort of circumstance, to do so in a very positive fashion by being supporting and loving of each other, again, overcoming any of those sort of petty differences or nonsense that very often bog down communities of any stripe, the, you know, the bickering and the internecine crap that happens, and just pull together and do what's necessary to make the best of such a horrible situation. And I just want to, before I do share the feature, since I pre-recorded it, I don't want to skip this first episode that I promised to put out, but I do want to give a moment of silence for my dear friend, for his loss, and the passing of a friend. One of the most fascinating things you can do with a computer is program it, and I'm convinced that anybody can learn how to program. While this series is not a comprehensive intensive set meant to get you spun up in any particular programming language, it should give you a good survey and grounding in what's required to learn how to program and inspire you perhaps to go beyond and pick a language and get started on your own. It's not just for the neophyte hacker, though. For all of you veterans out there, use the feedback channels, subscribe to the mailing list, and help me expand on these subjects. Send in references, your own anecdotes, anything that you choose to share that you think would help somebody else that's just getting started. As more applications make their way onto the web, it's actually in many ways starting to become almost a predominant way of developing new applications. Performance is once again starting to see a lot more discussion, or at least it seems to me. It seems like back in the good old client-server days, performance was an issue. Traditional programming performance was an issue. It seems like there was a bit of a lag before we started to have some serious in-depth discussions around the speed of web applications. Google in particular has been pushing on web performance for the latter half of this just past year, 2009. At some point, just about every non-trivial program that you write is going to encounter a performance problem of some sort. Some user is going to complain about a feature taking too long to run. This will be true whether it's a web application with client-side scripting or with server-side code, or a more traditional desktop application or some other kind of application besides. Even server software like databases and application servers, if you're lucky enough to do that kind of systems development, that's going to be a large component of what you're going to have to deal with if the application is successful and thriving. Another strong driver for performance as a concern is the drive towards ubiquitous computing, currently in the form of these internet devices and smartphones. In order for them to be more portable and to have a better battery life, they often have simpler, stripped down, and then, as a consequence, slower processors. People's expectations of them, though, are still quite high, so it puts a particular demand on those developing applications for those mobile devices. When dealing with performance, when considering this class of problems, a good understanding of algorithmic complexity, I think, is vital. I've talked about this form of complexity before, and I'll include a link to the inner chapter I did on the broader subject of complexity where I touched on this. In that installment, I was more concerned about managing the complexity of a code base that you're working on. Complexity there being a source of bugs and problems with that maintenance over time. Complexity, though, also is a critical piece to performance, especially understanding Big O notation, which is a simple shorthand for how many steps conceptually an algorithm performs for some arbitrary set of input. The order of complexity forms a very useful scale then for comparing algorithms, understanding their performance relative to each other. If you identify a problem section in your code and can quantify the order of its operations as, say, exponential from that list of orders of algorithmic complexity, then you already know that it's possible to do far better than that. You can then target your search for a way of rewriting the code to do the same thing, but use a more efficient algorithm. You want to get to linear, logarithmic, or constant time complexity, roughly what each of the classes of complexity here describe, and I've referred to the four most common ones, is the curve that you can plot out on a Cartesian plane, just an XY coordinate plane, with the size of your inputs on one axis and the number of resulting operations on the other. You should be familiar with at least the most common classes of algorithms, and I'll include a link to the excellent section in Wikipedia's Big O Notation article on the orders of common functions. It's very useful to bookmark and review. So, a constant time operation to start out with describes a flat or a horizontal line. Logarithmic time, the next most expensive class of algorithm, is a gently rising curve whose slope gradually decreases. It appears to approach a horizontal line, so it is more desirable than a linear algorithm, which I'll speak about next, as its rate of change over time is actually lower. It decreases. Linear time, then, is a straight line, but with a constant slope. So instead of a horizontal line, it's just a line at any other angle on that plane, but it's between any two points, it increases the same amount. Up through infinity, the rate of change in a linear algorithm is going to be constant. So yes, it's going to slow down, but it's going to slow down in direct proportion to the number of inputs that you have. The various classes of polynomial time all have in common exponential curves of some variety. So the rate of change actually accelerates over time. So the rate of exponentiation here, though, is a constant. So it's squared or cubic, even if it might be leading up to something even larger than that. The worst, most commonly seen class of algorithm is actually true exponential time, where the variable that changes, the driver for degradation of performance, is actually the exponent. So rather than so your inputs, actually, if you have n inputs, say 1,000 inputs, 10,000, million inputs, that's actually the power to which you're raising the complexity of that algorithm. So you can understand how that degrades much faster than the other ones I've described, where your inputs have a smaller effect on the curve being described. If you dig into that Wikipedia link, there are other subclasses, there are other gradations and nuances. This is a very active and sophisticated area of research in computer science. I've really just given you the briefest glimpse into this. And from my perspective, just as a practicing programmer, the most common classes of algorithms in terms of algorithmic complexity that I've had to deal with. And I haven't heard people in just common parlance when talking about performance and algorithm choice really refer to anything other than the handful that I've talked about and tried to give you some sense of. I really do encourage you to dig into that article, to look at other sources besides, to try to understand this topic to the point where you've got ideally a sort of intuitive grasp, so that when you're discussing this, you've got a good language, a good shorthand, and you have some sense of the effect, as I said, the interaction of your algorithm choice with the size of inputs as it ranges from best case scenario with a small number of inputs out to the worst case scenario, some ridiculously large set of inputs. So how do you actually figure out where a performance problem actually lies within your code? If you are very, very lucky, you'll realize some suboptimal algorithm just through reading through your source code. Odds are good that you'll need to search for that slow code in the actual running program. After finding it, you may be lucky enough to realize that a bad algorithm is at fault and have something that's fairly discrete where you can swap out for a better one. Observation of code here, though, is going to be your most powerful tool. You can learn a lot just from doing black box testing, that is firing inputs into your code without relying on any internal knowledge, just restricting yourself. And this requires a fair amount of discipline to empirical observation of how your program runs under a variety of circumstances with a variety of inputs. You want to use a scientific and disciplined approach here. Formulate a hypothesis. Just come up with an idea. It doesn't have to be right. That's not the point. You just want to have something that you can test about what you think the problem might actually be in your code. Design an experiment, some test or series of tests to put that hypothesis under the microscope, as it were. In this case, you're not going to do tests like in the troubleshooting interchapter that I did, the problem-solving one. You're going to do this more to try to put stress, to put load, to vary different inputs into the program to see which one has the most effect, to kind of narrow down. You also want to, before you get started, most critically, is actually run a baseline before you do anything else so that you know where you started. And then when you change things over time, you can compare back to that baseline and you've got a good sense of what it is that's evolving in your understanding and your observations. It's also a pretty good idea to build in some repetition into these kinds of load tests to smooth things out. You want to be able to factor out any kind of one-time operations such as initialization of external resources or loading of code modules into memory. Anything you repeat, you'll also want to consider automating. So these things tend to go hand in hand and will give you some good, you'll then be looking more at average performance over, say, 1,000 iterations rather than one-time performance. And that's going to, as I said, it is going to give you, it's going to help steer you away from any false results in your experimental findings, if you will. Also think about what algorithmic complexity actually tells us. That a performance curve may be a function of your inputs. So think about what variables actually define your inputs. By observation, you may realize a class of inputs that you didn't when you were actually designing and building the code, something that affects performance that you just didn't take into account that you may need to minimize. What's very often the case, one of the most high-profile things people will point to when hand-optimizing code are nested loops where you have two sets of inputs that are actually multiplied against each other, or even worse, one is actually raised to the power of the other. So you get that exponential curve that I was talking about. And if you don't realize that that's the case going in, you may be able to realize that observationally, that if you see that exponential spike in performance for a particular function, for a particular probe that you fire into your running code, that may be a good hint about what's going on there. Also, beyond just the literal inputs, the data your users are actually putting into the program, there are inputs that are not as obvious, like the number of users in a multi-user system is going to be something that's going to feed into any kind of problematic algorithms, any kind of performance problems in your system. And you need to make sure that you run each test as a set of tests, each one charting out a point and a range of inputs once you've identified or as you continue to evolve and identify those inputs so that you can actually, the point again to talk about this in terms of geometry, in terms of curves, is to be able to identify those very distinctive curves that tell you something, that give you a very clear, simple picture of what's going on from a performance perspective and can help guide you in to what it is that you need to address. In order to chart it out, to see that geometry as it actually plays out with the running program, you need to think about how you're going to get recordable results. Logging is often a very good option, but you may also want to add a little bit of code to directly record measurements in a more structured format, either into a database or something like a comma-separated value file, something like that, that's going to be amenable to actually dropping into a charting program of some sort, whether that's a spreadsheet or it's GNU plot or something like that. This is often referred to as instrumenting your code. When you're actually pulling data out that's not meant to be directly human readable, that's gathering statistical inputs or data like that, more often we talk about that in terms of instrumentation rather than logging. It, as I said, it's not necessarily meant to be human readable. Usually you output to a format suitable for further analysis. This would then let you do that necessary sort of visual comparison. And especially since you're going to want to run series, when you start to change things, so you're iterating your experiment, you want to have something that's directly comparable. So once you're not going to draw out a single line on your graph, you're going to draw out a line for each variable that you change as you progress through. Simple logging is, however, less intrusive, but may require a lot more parsing in order to feed instrumented data into this kind of analysis. That direct instrumentation of your running code may end up being more intrusive because you may instrument things like method entry and exit, other life cycle hook points in your application. But it's going to be easier to work with from an analytical perspective. Very often people will put instrumentation into a running application and turn them off, have a way to cleanly disable them so you can have permanent sensors and recorders built into your code. But when you turn them off, they don't cost anything or they cost very little, just that extra decision point to determine whether the instrumentation is currently on or off. That's really kind of the ideal case, being able to activate those in a production system to be able to directly observe the behavior where the customers are actually seeing a problem that they're reporting. So once you have that baseline, once you've kind of designed out your experiments, you've got your instrumentation in hand, you know how you're going to parse that, how you're going to chart that all out, you want to proceed by changing just a single aspect of the code. I've already mentioned this, but it's worth repeating. And then rerunning your test after each single small change, capturing that data. Like I said, this feeds back into that multi-plot analysis that you're going to run, so that you can compare the results and try to understand what it is that they're telling you. This is the sort of black box aspect of this, is that looking at those relative comparisons, so you're tracking your inputs, you're seeing visually what's coming back out, you can start to refine your hypothesis and ideally dial in and dial in and dial in until you identify the problem. Remember that if you change more than one variable, you won't know which variable is responsible for the observed differences in the output. You want to avoid what I've referred to, and I've seen this in my career, as thrash tuning. This is the opposite of actual performance tuning. You will be able to get pretty far just by continuing this very simple sort of scientific method inspired practice. Be sure to discuss your findings with your team too. Things that you find may spark ideas and inspiration or recollections of theirs, of similar problems that they've dealt with. So it's not necessarily, if you're lucky enough to be working collaboratively on a code base, it's not entirely up to you to interpret these results. You can just kind of do a small presentation to everybody else, or just get everybody together for a quick confab and say, here's what I'm seeing. I'm not really sure what's going on here, but somebody else might have an idea. And they might be able to give you things that can kind of feed back into that experimental process, suggest things that you can change to try to improve the results, to try to refine this. It's unfortunately, you may be getting this sense, it is a little bit of a black art at a certain level. There are tools that can improve this, automate it much more easily, that are designed specifically for this. And they're referred to as profilers. And there's a couple of different kinds of profilers. I'm going to talk about these just very quickly because I'm not as familiar with them. And they really almost deserve their own segment to discuss more in depth. It's also not a tool that I've seen too commonly used. It's not, it's, you know, if debuggers, interactive debuggers are used less often than we'd like, then profilers are used even less frequently in my experience. And each profiler also, to be fair, behaves a little bit differently. It requires a slightly different configuration, some specialized knowledge, which seems to be a little bit of a barrier to seeing them in more common usage. In a nutshell, what they do is they execute your code with instrumentation, and they usually provide a very standard, straight-up way to actually instrument your code in an automated fashion, so you don't have to do it manually. They usually do it at a very low level through some sort of interception in the code pathways, in the execution path of the running program. You might have an alternate instrumented library that you swap in or something like that. This actually also lets a developer very efficiently and effectively interrogate a running system. Again, much like an interactive debugger, I think these are substantially similar tools. And the syntax for doing so may be very simple, or it in some cases may be very sophisticated and very powerful. Profilers also usually have a way to capture and report on data, so you don't have to worry about that and write out all of that parsing and charting functionality that I was talking about by hand. Usually they have those built in, which is another leg up that it gives you. It frees you up to focus on what it is that you want to measure and how to exercise your code, and ultimately how to get through that iterative process to improve performance to solve some discrete problem. I'll look into trying to identify an expert on profiling for a future interview. I think that would be something very edifying for me, something beneficial for me, as much as it would be for you. If any of you guys know of any experts, preferably on an open source project, it doesn't necessarily have to be, but somebody that you think could speak very effectively to the use of profilers, even if it's just a specific profiler, we can kind of generalize out from there. I think that that would be pretty cool. Bear in mind that most profilers, in my experience, I don't know them that well as a class of tool, but from what I've seen, they're going to be limited to a given component. They're going to be limited to a given language or platform where your system is made up of different pieces. You may actually ultimately need a different profiler for each part of your application stack that you're working with. But, you know, if there's somebody knows of one out there that is more comprehensive, I've just never encountered one. I dearly love to hear about it. And as I said, I think this is a topic that we can reserve for another time to dig into profilers as a class separately and spend a good fair amount of time just talking about those. The cardinal rule of performance tuning is it is never what you expect at the outset. As I have talked about repeatedly, code is complex. It is difficult to predict from static analysis how it will run and behave. Even when you can observe and run the program, the internals are rarely simple enough to reliably correlate to what you are seeing with the internal state of the system. You have to have an open mind that you may be mistaken, that there may be surprising things in your findings. Your hypotheses, going back to that scientific method approach, are as likely to be disproven as they are to be confirmed. Each failed hypothesis, though, like in the progress of science, should lead you onto some new hypothesis that you can test and refine. By iterating and exploring, you'll pin down what the real problem is. By its very nature, you'll find the biggest time sinks in your code first. Each successive find after that will be smaller and probably harder to make. This is fine, since you want to economize, get the most reward for the least effort. If your system is lively, it will also change often enough that you may have to start over again with each major version that you release. Unless you take pains to share knowledge about performance issues too, it is possible, even likely, that your fellow collaborators, your teammates, will recommit errors that you found in earlier performance tests. Once you've started solving performance problems, they never stop, really, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. If your users continue to be concerned over performance, it means that they're using your system. It's important to them. It may also be a sign, especially for software run as a service, web applications, that it is growing in popularity. This may be a function of scaling up to meet greater demand. Performance problems are also rarely as definite as functional bugs in your code base when you're thinking about all of the different sorts of maintenance issues that you have to deal with. You are unlikely to know whether you've found and solved all of the performance issues in your application. Testing and discovery is likely to be a continuous need over time. Think of it like integration and acceptance testing. Like acceptance testing, you may even have clear inputs from users or customers. If you've built in any kind of automation, then think about integrating it with a continuous build loop that maybe not for every incremental build, but for release candidate or major milestone builds that you might want to run your performance tests and see if they meet any sort of expectations that you've coded in terms of how fast particular functions need to run. You may want to leave some instrumentation, as I've talked about previously, in the production code that you can enable to help diagnose spot problems that crop up. You want to try to gather enough info to make some predictions too ahead of complaints, and that production instrumentation can help with that. Be careful that doing so doesn't incur too heavy of a cost. Like I said, there's kind of a balance when dealing with leaving your instrumentation in. You don't want it to create its own performance problem. Bear in mind, too, that especially increasingly with web applications, you may have to deal with performance problems that lie outside of your code. If your system is made up of truly heterogeneous components, also make sure you are including each different piece. For example, start with a course examination of the web application, the application server, the database, any other elements in your stack. You may have biases informed by the parts with which you are most familiar. If you know the database best, for instance, you may feel inclined to focus your efforts in performance tuning there. Make sure you're taking those biases into account and at least initially being much more comprehensive in trying to search out where problems may lie. Enlist a collaborator if you have to, or an acquaintance who knows the parts that you don't, to try to help offset those biases. Increasingly, we are also seeing purely external systems, so not even just less familiar portions of your own stack, but in those sorts of mashups and the uses of hosted services that are outside of your control, those would be these purely external systems that you can't do anything but black box test them. And you may, if you're able to pin down a slowdown in your system in a more coarse-grained function or feature of your system to calling out to one of these, there may not be a whole heck of a lot you can do about this. If you're lucky, you can report a bug to a maintainer and they might be receptive to addressing a slowdown or performance issue, but you might have to consider alternate strategies, ways of working or hacking around this, like caching. In fact, that's the most common solution that I've seen for these purely external systems, and I'll just revisit some of the cardinal rules of caching that you'll want to have at a minimum some a conception of expiration built into your caches. And you may want to consider more complex ways of doing this if you're caching more than just a single simple blob of information, reading up on algorithms like LRU, least recently used, and comparable algorithms. And you'll definitely want to have ways to manually flesh out any sort of caching like this so that if you're trying to debug another problem, you can at least exert some manual control, some fine-grained control over that external data. Anyway, these are just some of my thoughts on kind of the state of speed and performance testing, just general tips and strategies and some things to think about. There's more that we can dig into and that we will dig into in future segments, digging into database performance and tuning specifically. I've already mentioned profilers. We could probably do a segment exclusively on various aspects common to web applications like in the browser and so forth. If you have your own general strategies, tips, anecdotes that you'd like to share on performance tuning, speed in applications, dealing with issues of speed, as always, send them on in to me. I'd be glad to hear them and to share them with everybody else. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I dearly appreciate you listening and bringing that surprise, that serendipity, both good and bad, into my life. If you enjoy the program, please go to the website at commandline.net and go to the support page for more information on how you can help with production of the show, either by making a donation, purchasing some swag, downloading a promo in order to help spread the word, or at the very least, telling a friend. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to post a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. The next show, as per usual, will be a news program, and we'll be up on the feed on Sunday, so until then, hold your loved ones dear, and don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank Liberated Syndication and Wouta DB for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits, and permission to recycle those further, except where noted, is granted under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 3.0 United States license. That means you're allowed to change and share this file as long as you share your changes, maintain attribution, and don't commercialize it without permission.